Malcolm, given the fact that you came a little bit later and Rajan had some issues, let me just weave this into, because it fits perfectly with what Rajan and I were about to discuss. Professor Rajan Menon, welcome again to Maria Report. We're very happy to have you. I'm glad that it has finally worked
Thanks,
out.
Axel.
Good to see you again.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. If I cut in and out, it's because something's going on at my end, but I'm standing where I have maximum reception, so bear with me.
That's excellent. Wonderful. Now, I was just about to it's very good that we spoke to Malcolm in this regard already, and evidently in your segment, you had just recently published two articles, which both fit into the whole mold quite perfectly, because they talk about the strategic options and the strategic situation, and that technically, what Malcolm and we discussed on our space early on, that with the defeat of the Hostomel and the original failure to capture their targets, the Russians already suffered a strategic defeat. They're trying to dig out from that, but they're losing half their army. They're losing their equipment. They cannot ever really win. They can just make it worse. Yes or no?
Yes. So let me distinguish between the military aspect and the strategic aspect. So let us stipulate, just for the argument's sake, that Putin pulls off something that he can spin as a victory. If you look at it strategically, here's what's happened. Two countries that had absolutely no intention of joining NATO, and both of whom have first-rate armies, Finland and Sweden, have joined the alliance because of Putin's invasion. That has complicated the already substantial difficulties of the Baltic fleet very much. He has, after being cut adrift from the West, created this strategic alignment with China. But if you talk to Chinese strategists, one thing has always come through to me over the years. They rather have contempt for the Russians. So that is not a good position to be in. Now, some people say, well, they have a lot of support from the global South, but that's not tangible support. So strategically speaking, I think he's already lost this war because Ukraine's trajectory, militarily, economically, politically, in terms of values, is westward. And remember that Putin didn't start this war to hive off a little bit of Ukraine. He began it to subordinate the country. In that respect, he has already failed.
Malcolm, that is pretty much what we said once before, and this is consistent with the analysis also at that time when you decided that you would go to Ukraine, literally, because you had enough, right?
Yeah. I had spent the previous month prior to the invasion doing an analysis of the Russian axes of attack, planned axes of attack, where they would have to come to actually carry out the invasion. And for those of you who know, the difference between academics and practitioners, in my world as an intelligence practitioner, you have to see the ground. And so I drove to all the border posts to the north. I'd been through Hostomel, I'd been through the Chernobyl Reserve, and you see we saw the state of the roads, I mean, which were horrific for a Toyota Pajero, right, of an SUV. And we just knew that the Russians were just going to be slowed down and slaughtered on many of these routes, which explains why the Russians, as a matter of fact, one of my more famous prognostications is when I gave what I called an unambiguous intelligence indicator, when we had seen a flight of, I think, 24, 17, some very large number of MI-17 HIPs had all gone to a forward rearm refuel point at the Ukrainian border. And that would become the airborne assault, air mobile assault on Hostomel Airport. But one of the things that I learned in the pre-war that really bugged me, my news media, I'm not a journalist, I'm a spy that talks on television. But one of the things that bugged me when I was at MSNBC is that they were sanguine. Their whole philosophy was Kiev will fall in 72 hours, get out of the city if you can. And, there's, and this is going to be a foregone conclusion in 2 weeks. I had spent time out in Avdiivka at the Joint Operating Command there with General Pavlyuk and General Sirsky, who was Commander of Land Warfare at the time. And it became very, very clear to me that the Ukrainian army was in the field a minimum of 2 weeks before the war started, and that all war stocks had been broken out, and that they were prepared for an invasion. They didn't want an invasion. The leadership was trying to keep people calm. But the Ukrainian army was the one factor no one in American government and the media were factoring, were calculating into their discussions. I actually famously went on air with Chris Jansing one day, and they had a guy from RAND Corporation who was talking about how fast Kyiv would fall. And I just literally interrupted the guy and go, "Dude, this city's never falling. Okay, you don't know who you're dealing with here." And the Russians would have to put down an enormous amount of throw weight. Little old ladies be throwing Molotov cocktails out of 20-story windows on top of you. This whole city will rise up and will defend itself. And also, the roads were in phenomenally horrible condition. I had driven down from Sumy all the way down to Chernihiv, and then from the Chernihiv border, where everyone was gathering near Belarus. And the roads in the middle of at the end of February were mud, and our truck was getting stuck in it. So 60-ton tanks weren't going anywhere. But that's an important factor for most people to know. The success of the Ukrainian defense, which created these tactical defeats that turned it into a theater level defeat, knocking out three different armies over the 90 days, was principally because the Ukrainian army was very well prepared. All the javelins were all out in the field. When I went to Gur and I went through their javelin shooters course, they had already had, javelin aces, 20, guys, 15, 20 kills. That were already rotated back to Yavoriv to give us their experience in how to use the javelin, the enlaw, and the stugna, which I got qualified on javelin and enlaw. But it was just phenomenal the amount of experience that the Ukrainians got quickly, and then how they applied that and then defeated the Russians and brought us right pretty much to where we are today.
It's good that you highlighted.
Axel,
Yes, please.
Just a quick word. I can't stay with you all that long as much as I'd like to. So can I just make a couple of points
Absolutely. I was about to hand it to you.
that pick up on what the previous speaker said. So I've been to Ukraine 4 times since the war started, and while I've not fought in the war, I've spent a lot of time with frontline soldiers. If Ukraine does badly in this war, it will not be for want of morale, because I have never met, and I literally mean not one person in the front or in the rear, who has said to me, "The suffering has gotten so bad that we have to cut a deal with Russia." And I've asked many people. Secondly, where are the Russian equivalents of General Zaluzhny and General Sirsky? Certainly not Valery Gerasimov. So the real issue is whether they will get the support. One of the things I think that hasn't been conveyed in the discourse in the West, certainly in the United States, where I live, is that the Russian military's performance, given the massive advantages that it had, has been pretty bad. And as the previous speaker said, the Ukraine army's obituary has been written since day one. And so people who have pumped up the Russian army need to give us an answer to a very simple question. Why is the so-called second superpower on the planet, with all of these advantages, still fighting as we enter year three of the war? The front line in 2023, the Russians had a net gain of about 148 miles. That's about half the circumference of Kiev. Their losses of equipment based on geolocated data are staggering, about 14,000 pieces of equipment in all. They've been pulling out tanks that are as old as I am, and nobody should be as old as I am. So it's really stunning. The Black Sea Fleet, 25% of their Ships and submarines are either destroyed or out of commission. I had a discussion with a former lieutenant colonel who's on the different side of this debate than I am, and he said, all that proves is that the era of surface ships are gone. I'm sorry, but that's not all it proves, because the attacks on Crimea have not been limited simply to vessels, but also to command posts, fuel depots, logistical lines, airfields, communication centers, and the Ukrainians have lost a lot of officers. It's not for nothing that Admiral Sokolov, the commander-in-chief of the Black Sea Fleet, was fired. So this hasn't come across well enough. Let's just briefly, and I'll leave it there because I don't want to hog the airtime, take a look at the celebrated victory in Avdiivka that the Russians have pumped up and as Putin has presented as a textbook campaign. They lost 26,000 people there. In the last week, three of the brigades they sent in had to be pulled out because they were pretty much decimated. And despite all of their human wave tactics, this was a very costly victory. And what did they inherit? A town that before the war had 32,000 people, has now 900 people, primarily older and disabled people, and it's been turned to debris. So it's something of a pyrrhic victory. I don't want to minimize the difficulties that Ukraine faces. I'm happy to talk about that if you'd like. So I think there's been an exaggeration here that the momentum is inevitably on the Russian side. And I have a lot of friends on the other side of the debate who will stick to this narrative no matter how much evidence you give them. So I think one of the things that needs to be done is to point out that, in fact, this is not so.
Mm-hmm. I think you're violently in agreement on many items, by the way. But Malcolm, please.
Rajan, can I ask you a quick question? Because, like I said, I was in Avdiivka D-10 before the invasion, getting briefed by General Sirsky and Pavlyuk. And I literally thought I had a friend who was assigned there. The furthest Ukrainian positions were 70 meters from the Russian positions pre-war. And I thought Avdiivka would go in the first hours of the war. And I know they had it built up very, very solidly. But it is miraculous that hard point has held since 2014. Would you agree?
Absolutely. Not, let's even start the clock, Malcolm, later. Let's start it in February 24th. Of 2022, this most recent iteration of the war. They took 4 months to take Avdiivka. And I still maintain that had the Ukrainians had the equipment that they needed, the loss was not foreordained. Let me give you another example, which Malcolm, of course, you know very well. And that is the beachheads that they've created on the left bank, Russian held in Kryvyi Rih. When the Ukrainians established that, the New York Times immediately wrote a piece based on interviews with Ukrainian soldiers about how demoralized they were. This was a suicide mission. This could never be held. The retired lieutenant colonel, my friend that I talked to, said it's going to be wiped out in a number of days. They've not only held it, but they have inflicted major damage. Just the other day, Shoigu, the defense minister, went to Putin and said, Mr. President, I have good news for you. They've taken Kryvyi. And Putin said, well, that's not my information. I understand that there's still some Ukrainian soldiers there. So Shoigu scrambled and he called the local commander and said, I want Kryvyi taken. And there were several assaults and massive losses. Now, this from a group that consists largely of Marines. They have artillery that they're firing from the high ground on the other bank of the river. But the fact that they've held on to it is extraordinary.
I think you're both violently in agreement that the achievements by the Ukrainian military, both in terms of holding certain positions or utilizing and employing them vis-a-vis the failed strategies and attack, say, vectors of the Russians, have been rather positively surprising, but astonishing at times.
I find it fascinating that the strategy that we were briefed when our first elements of the Legion rolled into Severodonetsk and Lysychansk, that's where Gord had a big Western presence when we were fighting for Severodonetsk. The strategy was described quite simply to me as head against anvil, and that the Ukrainian forces would create these anvils, and they would let the Russians pound their head against it until they bled. And then they would, the Ukrainians with withdraw, leave them a ruin, bleed them dry, and then do it all over again. And the Russians have never failed to take the bait every time.
Axel, just so that I don't come off as Pollyannish, I want to raise some of the things that I see that particularly worry me. And I say this based on my most recent trip, which was in December, where I was in a safe house with a group of Ukrainian soldiers who, after several drinks, opened up. The morale remains very high, but these guys have been on the front line fighting, some since 2014, definitely since the last 2 years. And there is a need for rotating training and replenishing the ranks. That's one thing. It's not easily done for complicated reasons. The second is, I worry that if Western aid fails to come through, and let me add that as much as the West Europeans can do, nobody in short order can fill the void left by the United States. Let's keep in mind that the U.S. has provided about $45 billion, whatever the figure, which is more than all the rest of the allies concerned. Combined. I'm particularly worried about the air defense of Ukrainian cities. And here's my big worry. In December, January of 2022, I happened to be there when they were trying to take out the power grid in big cities in Kiev and so on. At that time, I went to Kherson as well. But that's another story. The focus here was on, oh, the Ukrainians will freeze to death, or the Ukrainians won't have light. Well, you can make heat by cuddling together or using blankets, whatever. You can make light with candles. The one thing you cannot make is water. And Mayor Klitschko, the mayor of Kiev, his worry was that if the water supply and the plumbing supply, the plumbing systems began to fail as a result of the grid suffering massive attacks, there may be a public health hazard that would require the evacuation of major cities. Now, in wartime, that would be very difficult. I worry, and we're a long way from next winter, that is going to be a problem. The second is, and this I think Malcolm would agree with in the Avdiivka case, the artillery ratio is still not anywhere near where it needs to be for the Ukrainians to be effective. Western Europe was supposed to deliver 1 million shells by March. Now they say they've delivered about slightly less than half, and the rest won't be delivered at the earliest by the end of the year. And while the Russians have been not very impressive, there are some ways in which they have made improvements. They've made, and I say this based on a conversation I had with a drone operator in Izyum. They have made big investments in drones. Even the Shahids that they use now are being modified and souped up. But they have a whole range of both surveillance and strike zones. So it's not just Shahids and Mavics anymore. It's a whole another thing. They've made fairly big strides in electronic countermeasures against drones, and also to some extent against HIMARS and the some of our artillery shells. Not enough to nullify them. There was a piece written in Foreign Affairs saying HIMARS has completely been nullified, so has Storm Shadow. That's complete nonsense, because they've been used to great effect quite recently. They've also learned to fight a little bit more smartly, so they're not to be underestimated. Now, people make fun of the Russians for these human wave tactics where they're stepping over dead bodies to get to the front and so on. And that is a different way of fighting than Ukrainians, who are, mindful of their soldiers' lives. However, the problem with these human wave attacks is that every time they come at you, you've got to use ordnance. And if you're short on supplies, that is really a big problem. So I've long since stopped trying to explain to people who are not American the nature of our politics, because I can't figure it out. But if this bill doesn't come up even for a vote in the Congress, it is going to make a very substantial difference.
This is what Jack Watling wrote at RUSI, that mm-hmm. essentially at the beginning it would be tentatively, you could see it in certain locations and the Ukrainians would have to withdraw. But if they were unable to exert fire control and do counter battery fire, then this would have massive impacts. But carry on, please, Malcolm.
Yeah, counter battery was a huge part. Last year when I met Minister Reznikov, it was fascinating because I was the first Legionnaire he had ever met, considering the Legion had been in operation for 14 months. And we had a discussion about counter battery. He spelled out for the group I was with that that last year's counteroffensive was not going to be like the one I participated in Kharkiv province, which was a blitz. It was going to be a series of phases that would place a lot of pressure on a lot of Russian points all at the same time, and hopes that the line would break in multiple places. But the first thing they did was they did a counter battery campaign from May until July. Everything went after Russian artillery. I had heard this story about that the Ukrainians were having degraded capability with the MLRS and HIMARS because of Russian jamming. They were using strategic GPS jamming. Anybody who's been out near the line will notice that their phone sometimes says you're in Volgograd. And if you put your GPS coordinates in to go to Kiev, it leads you to like Kursk. And we knew that those strategic systems were out there. They're very large, high platform, strategic platforms that the Russians were jamming us with. The Ukrainians, with the assistance, I can't say specifically where it came from. I am almost 1,000% certain it came from National Geospatial Intelligence Agency and the National Reconnaissance Office. We're good at identifying big jammer transmittery things, either through NSA and then putting eyes on it on satellite. And the way that we resolved the HIMARS jamming problem was to physically kill that jammer, you know? And the Ukrainians dedicated some resources to it. And, you know, the Ukraine has resources that a lot of you probably don't think about, but they do have partisans. They have people that can drive who are in the Russian-occupied territories who will drive right up to that spot and take a look at it. You know, little old ladies, as we used to set joke with telephones and apps that were given to them. That's probably not how it was done. It was probably done through U.S. strategic intelligence. But we got rid of their countermeasure. And then suddenly, you know, HIMARS capability and our, precision rounds suddenly got their mojo back. So, you know, people like the professor said, anyone who's out there saying that HIMARS is done has never seen this thing kill things. And when it kills good. So now what we need is the Ukrainians are emphasizing deep fires, which is to take out, and the Ukrainians are really, really, really good at precisely determining Russian rail logistics points. And if you think about it, between 2022 and 2023, there were enormous numbers of ammunition dumps. As soon as HIMARS got there, ammunition dumps started blowing up everywhere, because the collaborative effort between NATO intelligence, U.S. intelligence, and the Ukrainians, we're good at determining where ammunition is being stored, and all it requires is one HIMARS round to knock those things out. And so by knocking the rail hubs out, the logistic forward points really helped a lot. But the Russians aren't stupid. They started to disperse more and use more of their long-range fires as well, including one that blew up my headquarters from 40 miles or 40 kilometers. The 203-millimeter artillery that fired from Russia to hit where we were in Ukraine. So all of these capabilities, every side is adaptive. Ukraine is more adaptive. But, when I sat down with the National Security Council, they were like, oh, well, what would you think you need? And one of the first things that the Ukrainians may have mentioned to them but couldn't be known from the field was, we were going through M240 barrels quickly. And because of the Russian change in tactics in 2022, you were squirting with these things, right? In 2023, you're hosing Russians down. My battalion alone was reporting to me that they were literally getting into firefights where they became tired of shooting people. And it was burning through all of our barrels and, you know, things, you know, machine gun barrels. So, you know, this colonel at the National Security Council hadn't heard that. And he said, well, maybe we should triple up our logistics, our, you know, automatic weapons logistics for M2 50 calibers and M2 40Gs. And I was like, bees, perfect. And, you know, that's the kind of thing you don't think about, you know, when you're on, you know, when you're watching people ask for ATACMs and things like that.
Axel, this will have to unfortunately be my last comment. Okay. I wish I could stay with you more, but I cannot. I'm not going to, in a public forum, discuss how I know what I know and who I met. That's not appropriate here. I think in terms of countermeasures, yes, there is always an attempt to foil emerging Russian electronic countermeasures, but it's a dynamic process, and they are also investing themselves. So it's something to be watched. One other thing that I worry about, as we all know here, the front line stretching from maybe Svatovo all the way down to Kherson is about 600 miles long. And here, numbers unfortunately make a difference. The Russians have already amassed significant forces to attack Crimea, try to break the Svatovo-Crimea line. I'm not saying they're going to do it, but they are trying. They are massing forces across from Sinkiv to take Kupiansk with the hope of taking Kharkiv. I don't think that'll happen, but they're massing forces. In Bakhmut, Chasiv Yar, and Ivanovska remain still at risk. And then there's Rabotino, where they've massed forces. Now, whether or not this succeeds is not the point, but they have the ability to mass forces on so many different points of the front line, and the Ukrainians, in terms of manpower, cannot match them. And if you add to that a deficit in firepower, that is a really big problem. So I come back to the question of how sustainable is Western support. Can the West Europeans in particular get their act together better than they've been able to do? Let's take, for example, the discussions in Germany on the Taurus missile. It ought to be a fairly straightforward measure decision, but it's not, because Scholz doesn't want to provide it, and there's opposition even in the Bundestag. So, Axel, I'm going to have to leave it there and sign off. Thank you very much for inviting me.
It has been our pleasure and our privilege to have you here, Bojan, and thank you very much. I shall hope that we can do a dedicated segment soon again in a lot more detail, but I think it was worthwhile and very valuable to have you here today with us on this commemorative anniversary.
I'd love to. All the best.